Welcome to the Natural Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Andrew Whitfield Cook. Join us as we interview expert clinicians, researchers, and well-being experts from around the world and explore the evidence and application of complementary medicine in global healthcare. The following podcast is intended as professional information for integrative practitioners and as such must not be taken as medical advice. Patients are expressly directed to seek appropriate care from a suitably qualified practitioner. Hi everyone, thanks for your company today. Joining us again today is Lisa Moan, the pediatric naturopath, and we'll be continuing with part two of childhood anxiety. Welcome back to Natural Medicine Podcast, Lisa. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks, Andrew. Thanks for having me back today.
Absolute pleasure. I've got to say, I was so enamored with what we discussed in part one. So let's continue. Let's dive right in. What are some of the ways in which you attempt to improve microbial diversity? I know that you've mentioned things like prebiotics and probiotics, but let's dive right in. Do you use particular strains? Do you stagger them or stratify them at all?
So I tend to use prebiotics to try and improve the diversity whilst we work on the diet. So, and I'll use, GAS, PHEG, lactulose. I'll use them all, sometimes all even within the same child. Ultimately, we might build them up to using all different ones. And in terms of food diversity, obviously that's very lacking with a lot of the children, but I just try and find diversity where I can. So, you know, if they're only eating one type of rice cake, I'll try to get them to eat all the different types of rice cakes, which is going to improve the diversity of their diet first and foremost, more so than the gut, but it's a stepping stone. And with the older children I work with, I do talk to them about aiming for 30 plant foods every week. Which I love that because it takes the pressure off. You need to eat more fruits and vegetables because these children identify as people who do not eat fruits and vegetables. So if I said, I want you to eat 30 fruits and vegetables every week, it'd be like, no, that's not going to happen. Yeah. But plant foods, you know, we've got oats, we've got brown rice. It's amazing. Some kids love quinoa and you would think, oh my goodness, that's such a like an adult trendy food. But I've given quinoa to kids and they're just like, oh my God, this is amazing. So getting diversity in the whole grains to start off with, and then things like seeds, pumpkin seeds, sunflower seeds. Again, children don't have a mindset that I'm not a seed eater because nobody has ever suggested that they eat seeds before. So a lot of the kids I see will take a little container of sunflower seeds or pumpkin seeds to school with them for their munch and crunch. So whilst everybody else is eating their cucumber or their capsicum, they have their seeds. So, and I'll, with the older kids, we will work through lists together of, you know, so what new plant foods did you eat this week and try and just build it until we get to 30, which is a lofty goal for anybody, but with a bit of planning and a bit of thought behind it from the parents and from the child, it can be achievable.
Do kids who suffer from anxiety, do they tend to prefer introducing one food at a time, like you just mentioned, eating their pumpkin seeds or their sunflower seeds, rather than I'll get a trail mix, I'll get the cashews and walnuts and hazelnuts, they're my favorite, you know. So I find I've missed out if I haven't got a walnut or a hazelnut in the mix. Do you find that they tend to cope with these small increments and then you can start to put it all together?
Absolutely. So, you know, offering a stir fry to a fussy eater is, you know, a nightmare because it's just everything together at once. But offer them some just fried capsicum on its own as a stepping stone with the rice, you know, in a month or two, they might be able to tolerate the stir fry. But yes, separate initially and then bring it together when they're comfortable with all the different pieces.
And is part of this that sensory difference in the foods, like a nut or a seed is a different sensory feel than a piece of capsicum?
Absolutely. So, I mean, I make these amazing crackers with rosemary and all these different nuts and seeds. And I think they're amazing. But you give it to a fussy eater and they're like, no, this is wild. We've got the texture, but it's all slightly different because you've got the chia seeds and the pumpkin seeds. And then we've got this flavor out of nowhere, the rosemary, and they're like, whoa, like you think it's a crunchy food, they're going to like it, but no, it's just way too busy. But give them the individual components separately, which to me is a very unpalatable way to eat a sunflower seed, just to sit down with us. But they're fine with that because they can identify what they're eating and deal with it.
Yeah. So you said the words then, deal with it. So is part of this food restriction from kids suffering anxiety, is part of that journey that I've said the word control before and you sort of said, no, not really, but is it part of a way of them dealing with the anxiety to say this is too much? I mean, I don't know, is it sensory overload?
Yeah.
Is that the issue?
Well, you know, sensory can be different to anxiety. I mean, it can fuel the anxiety, but it can also be separate. But it's more about, you know, the way they deal with their feelings of anxiety is just to avoid.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where just avoiding the experiences is how they deal with it.
Right. And you also mentioned right at the beginning how basically the first interview is majorly with the parent or concentrating on the parent. Is there ever a time when you really start to delve into the child's feelings of anxiety and really explore them? Or do you tend to refer that job out to a psychologist or somebody appropriately trained?
Yeah. So a lot of the times, yes, I will just, and a lot of children are already working with psychologists when they come to see me. And some psychologists will phone me up and we'll have a chat, which is obviously the best way to do it, is just to collaborate and have that open communication. With older children who I'm seeing face to face, I will try to challenge some of their views. So if they, you know, if I present them with a food and they just go, yuck, that's disgusting. And I'm like, well, is it? Have you tried it before? How do you know it's disgusting if you've never tried it? So I do challenge them. Or if, you know, sometimes I'll do a little exercise and I'll have little pots with different flavors. So there'll be like cocoa powder to be bitter. I might have some Sour Patch Kids to, you know, to show what sour flavor is. Some, you know, food to show what sweet is. Some pungent foods like sauerkraut. And I'll get the children to name the taste, name the flavor. And they'll get it wrong most of the time because they've never had any of these foods before. So I'm trying to kind of just challenge where their assumptions and their beliefs about food are actually incorrect. So it's not about judgment, feeling yuck, yum. It's like, no, that answer is incorrect.
Yeah, but it's really interesting. I love your mind. Like the way, instead of just challenging about do you know, you're teaching them. You're saying, this is what sour is, this is what salty is, this is what bitter is.
Yeah.
And learning that these are not necessarily dangerous sensations. They're just different types of foods.
Yeah, and they're not good and bad. So we don't have to, you know, describe a flavor as yuck. We can describe it as pungent or bitter or, you know, and obviously my background in the food industry has kind of equipped me to do these things because I have, I would say, you know, a good repertoire of food of labels to describe foods because that's what I did in my previous job. So that's the sort of thing we'll do. And then it takes the emotion out of the mealtime. So, you know, what's a bitter food? Like dark chocolate, you know, kids will obviously normally prefer milk chocolate. But if you can explain to them dark chocolate, it's bitter. And they're like, oh, okay, so it's still chocolate, but it's bitter, whereas milk chocolate is sweet. And it stops them getting emotional about decisions and more rational.
Yeah, well, let's talk about bioflavonoids. I mean, raspberries, you know, if you really drill down to a raspberry, less sweet than a strawberry, but God, give me raspberries any day.
That's my favorite food, raspberries.
Raspberries and blackberries.
With some children, success is actually getting them off milk chocolate and onto daily dark chocolate.
Yeah, right.
You know,
How dark do they handle? Above 70% or?
Yeah.
Do they tend, really?
Especially if they're a sensory seeker. So the ones that want, you know, not all children want bland flavors.
Yeah.
Some kids do best if you just add chili sauce to everything. So if they're a sensory seeker, then they'll, you know, they might love the dark chocolate.
Oh, now that's something I've never explored. Sensory seeker.
Yeah.
Take us into this a little bit.
Yeah. So like some, so occupational therapists will often, you know, assess a child and do a sensory profile for them, which then the parents can send to me. And most children will be like sensory avoiders. So they'll just want to avoid stimulus, but there will be some who want the input and they want the stimulus. And so I have one particular child who was extremely fussy, now will eat everything, but mostly with chili sauce.
Right. So even a let's say a berry or something like that?
Well, like main courses, I don't know about dinner, but like fruits and stuff. But with his dinners, the mom just puts a bit of chili with it and just makes it really super spicy. And he was three at the time. Like he wasn't a teenager. He was three when she realized that if she just spiced it up, he would eat it.
Oh, that's interesting with the TRPV1 receptor. That's a whole other conversation, that one. So a sensory seeker, that's something I've never explored before. That's a whole other course. What about microbial diversity? Now, you know, we've gone into prebiotics, probiotics. You've said that you are quite heroic in dosing. Can we delve into specific strains? Do you favor certain strains? Do you tend to use a mix
of probiotics?
Of probiotics, yeah.
So it depends on the condition. So if, you know, constipation is one of the main issues that's causing the food restriction, then I'll give them Lactobacillus reuteri, DSM 19278. But the reason, I mean, that one is good for reflux as well, which is also another reason why kids don't eat. They have the aversive conditioning that every time I eat, I get pain. Why would I eat?
Yeah.
So giving them that can help the reflux, which can then reduce the barrier to eating. But also, I mean, as I said before, the best supplement is the one that your child will take. And children love the chewable version of that. I give it to all my fussy eaters just before I even meet them.
Right.
Because they love it and they'll take it and it's going to help. And then, you know, I use Saccharomyces boulardii if there's parasites or low secretory IgA. So I wouldn't say I favor any strain, but I do, like, I use Probiotic Advisor all the time to pick the right strain for the patient.
Yeah. And what about mixes? Do you ever use, like, for instance, you know, let's say we're getting off topic here, but let's say atopic predisposition, you could use LGG, you could combine it with HN001. Both of them are Lactobacillus rhamnosus, just different providers, different patent providers. Do you tend to mix strains at all?
I use the mixes that are available, like as a mix. I use those, the ones that have been, you know, formulated for specific conditions. Like something I see a lot of is environmental allergens. So dust mite allergens in particular are skyrocketing. So I'll use the specific blend of probiotics. I can't remember what's in it, but I'll use the specific blend that reduces your sensitivity to environmental allergens. And again, get great success with that.
Okay, brilliant. And something we haven't really delved into yet, we mentioned a few things, but lifestyle factors. So you mentioned your early childhood with Dr. Vogel's book.
Yeah.
You know, the nature doctor. And we lose in touch with this simple stuff. Yeah. I mean, even to the point where, you know, kids will go at school and they'll have recess and lunch. The wise teacher with their kids that might have behavioral issues will try and incorporate some exercise into a class, maybe, to get them, you know, to expend the energy so that they're not cooped up, they're not pent up.
Yeah.
How important is this when dealing with childhood anxiety, particularly relating to food?
It's just so important. You just can't overemphasize it enough. One of the schools near me, actually, they do like a park run. It's not 5 kilometers. Every morning before school, the whole school goes like and does a 2K run around the park every day, all of them. And it makes perfect sense. Like, those kids are going to be cool, calm, and cooperative for their day at school, as opposed to the kids who, you know, go straight into their classroom and sit down or whatever. But getting out into nature should be, you know, what kids do when they're not at school. They should be outside, riding their bikes at the park, gardening. You know, gardening is the best because they're interacting with the food. So they're getting systematically desensitized to food without any pressure to eat it. So you don't have to eat the tomato. We're just picking the tomatoes, or we're just, you know, picking the lettuce or whatever. So plus they're getting the diversity, you know, in their gut just by being out in the garden. So it's, you know, if you want to do one, well, most important thing is family mealtime. Second thing, get your child out in the garden, interacting with their food. You know, vitamin D, the actual physical activity, everything that you need is available if you just get out in nature. I'm extremely fortunate. I live on the escarpment here on the Illawarra, so I can be in the bush 30 seconds from my house. And if my kids are in a feral mood, that's what we'll do. We'll just go and we'll stomp our way to the bush with the dog.
Yeah.
By the time we come home, everybody's like happy as Larry again. But yeah, it's just kids. It's the opposite of what kids are actually doing. So what kids are actually doing is coming home from school and sitting on their devices and then eating in front of their devices.
Yeah.
And oh, guess what? My child can't sleep.
Yeah. Yeah. So, duh.
You know, it's you have to turn it completely on its head from what has become normal and get outside.
But if there's one positive thing that's come from COVID-19, it's that some people decided that they needed an interaction with nature being to grow a veggie patch. And the experience of growing something and putting care into it, it's not just about the vegetable, it's about the learning of how you take care of something, how you watch it grow, what you have to put in to get something out, all of those lessons in life.
Yeah.
You know, if there's one positive thing, it's growing a veggie patch.
Yeah. Yeah. Because we're just too disconnected
away
from our food and where it comes from.
Now, I've got to ask, you said to me off air, you have some chickens.
Yes.
Do you get eggs from them? And
oh, yes. Yeah. We just, we get 6 eggs every day. So with the kids who come to see me for face-to-face feeding therapy, the food that they don't eat, we then just walk across to the chickens and we feed it to the chickens.
Yes.
So to feed it to the chickens, you have to touch the food. So we're already making progress on the way to eating because they know they don't have to eat it because we're now just feeding the chickens. So they'll touch, you know, 10 pieces of capsicum. And then if they're just loving it, I'll say, now we say goodbye to the capsicum. Mwah! Goodbye to the capsicum. And then they'll go, mwah! And they'll pop it in. And then, you know, so they'll work their way up and say, well, let's do one blueberry for us. One, my chickens love blueberries. $45 a kilo. Awesome. One blueberry for us, one blueberry for the chicken. And they'll, because they're so happy and they're so relaxed and there's no pressure, we're just having fun with the chickens. They might not have eaten anything when we're sitting inside because it's like, you know, a lot more intense, but go out, feed the chickens, and then they're eating blueberries, they're eating capsicum, they're eating all this stuff, but without pressure, just because it's so much fun.
Yeah. You know, you've just attentioned me to something that I have totally omitted, totally not thought about in talking about childhood anxiety, and that is the importance of animal interaction. Can we talk a little bit about that? Like, you have chickens, but do you encourage your patients to have animal interaction of some sort, whether it be their own pet or go into the zoo or something like that?
Yeah. So I have an adorable a dog. So I will bring him down often with the kids who are not terrified of dogs. I will bring the dog down maybe at the start of the session or the end of the session. Just to, you know, because he's adorable. Like he makes everybody happy. So I will bring him to the end of the session just to end on a high as well. But yeah, to reduce allergies and everything, like, but there's so much benefit to having a pet.
Yeah. Would you ever employ an animal like, let's say, as almost like a service animal? Say at meal times, if you've got a particularly anxious child who's, into food avoidance, would you ever employ the inclusion of that animal at meal times? Whereas most families say, no, the dog's over there. You don't include the animal at, with the kitchen table. The whole thing is you've got to get the child over the anxiety. And do you ever employ animals like in that way? Yeah.
So, I mean, generally
Break the
speaking,
rules.
if your family is eating well, then you shouldn't really have the dog there as a distraction. But if your child won't touch any of the foods that are available to them to eat at the end of the mealtime, then that food just they have to scrape it into the bin. Or I do get them to feed it to the dog sometimes because again, they have to interact with the food to get it off their plate and over to the dog, they have to touch the food. So again, it's
Ah,
automatic desensitization. Every
so even, sorry, so even if it's like an initial avoidance, it's getting the child used to that sensory investigation of food.
Yeah, it's all about systematic
Ah.
desensitization in a playful way. So,
Yeah.
you need the competing kind of stressful event plus the play event to make systematic desensitization work. So having a nice, happy dog to individually feed the food to is the perfect way to do it.
So that's when a loss is always a win.
Yeah. And I'm sure there's dog people who know a lot more about dogs than me listening to this going, don't do that. That's the worst thing you can teach a dog to do. But I'm not really focused on the dog's well-being. I'm just focused on the kid's well-being.
Let's delve into nutraceuticals and herbs that you've used. You mentioned a few in part one. Let's really dive into what you use, what you favor, what doses you use, and how you get the children to take them. So you mentioned early on, for instance, zinc, huge issue with deficiency in Australia with our soils. Mostly we don't have issues, but some people do have issues with taking zinc, particularly on an empty stomach. How do you start to employ taking zinc? Do you tend to use the liquid zincs over the tableted formulations? Tell us about it.
So I'll usually start with a transdermal zinc
Ah, okay.
because fussy eaters who are deficient in zinc tastes horrific. So you just can't even get off the starting block with zinc using an oral supplement in a lot of children. So I straight up just go to transdermal for all the extreme fussy eaters. And I find that after about a month on transdermals, then they're ready to take an oral supplement. And again, every child is different. Some love chewable versions. Some of the kids I see cannot actually chew well enough to do a chewable one. So we might do a powder or a zinc. And then some kids will take anything if it's in a spray. So, and there's none available in Australia, so they sometimes have to look overseas, but there's some zinc sprays, and that will work for, there's a surprising amount of children that will only take a spray for zinc. So yeah, you just have to gauge it, but I pretty much start with the transdermal for zinc for everybody.
Just interjecting there, a couple of times through this podcast and part one, you've mentioned chew. The kids can't chew properly. What's going on there?
So if you've got low muscle tone in your body as a whole, then sometimes you just can't chew properly. So to chew meat, an immature chew is just up and down, munching. Then, when a child gets, I don't know the exact age, but say like 12 months, they need to develop a rotary chew. And that's how you break down the fibers in meat. But if for some reason you never transitioned your child off purees and mash onto proper table foods, your child missed out on that developmental stage in the first chew, which then they may now have speech issues because those muscles are not working correctly. So you have to meet them where they're at and train, teach them how to chew.
So what about employing chewing gum? I mean, not the least of which it's going to stimulate saliva, but to improve muscle tone.
Yeah, I use that. And again, kids love that as an intervention. More when they're sort of 5 years old. But yeah, there's some kids where they need to really work on that, especially if there's significant speech issues. They need to work on that tone in their mouth. So yeah, I get them to chew gum for 20 minutes a day.
And do you tend to favor like, a xylitol containing gum over a saccharin or a aspartame containing one?
Exactly. Use xylitol once you're getting some oral microbiome benefits as well.
Yeah, I would imagine that these kids who are anxious and they are fussy eaters, I would imagine that they're going to have particular dental issues as they grow if they don't rectify their eating issues.
Yeah, a constant supply of starch in the form of rice crackers is just the worst thing for your teeth. So yeah, a lot of them have, significant dental issues.
There's so many things that must run through your mind like this.
If you've got dental issues, then it hurts to chew. So again, it's averse of your, if you've developed dental issues, you're not going to want to chew proper food. You're going to want smoothies and pureed food to make it less painful.
Yep. Okay. So earlier, part one, you mentioned that you do a lot of hair mineral testing analysis. What are the common issues that arise? Obviously, this is going to be particular for each child, but what are the common issues that you see and how do you approach treatment?
Yeah. So certainly a lot of high copper, low zinc on hair tests, like a lot. And then I see a shocking amount of heavy metals, so lead, mercury, arsenic, and then aluminium as well. I had a boy recently who their water supply is artesian water, so it's bore water from which the council is testing. And his lead was, he's three, he just turned three. His lead wasn't just off the chart, it was off the chart again. So it was like twice the scale. And so I sent them for blood tests, and again, really, really high on blood too. So being exposed. So yeah, that's, and mercury as well. See, really high mercury and aluminium. So then how I approach it, it really depends on the combination of what is going on in totality for that child.
Yeah. We had an issue where, a lot of people were sort of blaming copper for high copper. But is that an issue of low zinc, not high copper? Is it like, are we shooting the messenger sort of thing when we see high copper? Is the issue low zinc?
Yes, exactly. So it's like a seesaw. And fussy eaters are generally not eating any meat because of the chewing issue. And therefore, they are very deficient in zinc, which affects their sense of taste and affects their sensory regulation and their mood and everything. So yes, it's definitely a low dietary intake of zinc being a big part of the problem.
Gotcha. And do you tend therefore to supplement or to try to supplement zinc on an empty stomach so you're getting what you can from your food and then getting zinc, or do you try and have an interaction a competitive inhibition with copper by having the zinc with food to try and bring that copper absorption down?
I would only ever give zinc with food, just because if you make a child nauseous once, then they'll never take it again. So just always give it with food.
Gotcha.
And they're not eating any zinc or copper or phytate containing foods anyway. So
okay, so how then do you approach the issue of iron as well when you've got, 8 to 12% of kids being iron deficient? We haven't even gotten to iodine, but with iron, how do you approach that when you've got to take zinc with your food? Oh, no, and iron is best taken on an empty stomach, right?
Well, no. So what I do is I do alternate day dosing. So I do zinc one day, iron the next, because iron's best absorbed alternate days. And then, interestingly, whilst they compete for absorption, if you're iron deficient and zinc deficient, it will be very hard to bring your iron up without bringing your zinc up. So zinc deficiency contributes to iron deficiency. Right. So I just, to make it simple for the parents, I just do right Monday, Wednesday, Friday, do iron. Tuesday, Thursday, Saturday, do zinc.
Perfect. Thank you. You've just attention me to something that I keep banging on to my patients about, and that is that the issue of taking particularly high dose iron every day will induce hepcidin, which is an inhibitor, a direct inhibitor for around about 48 hours of iron absorption. So that alternate day, even orthodox, we're seeing orthodox medicine now acquiesce to something that naturopaths have been talking about for 12 years.
Yeah.
So that's a really important lesson. Thank you, Lisa. I'm so ashamed that I forgot about that.
And I've seen kids who have been on 100 milligrams of elemental iron, 100, and they're fair every day. So obviously tummy pain, constipation, feeding all those E. coli's in the gut, and their ferritin still hasn't budged. Drop them down to 24 milligrams every second day, and their ferritin comes straight right up.
That's right. It just takes longer. So the stuff that was discussed in, I think it was Australian Doctor, forgive me if that's wrong, it was talking about iron, and they were saying that it took, I think it was up to 3 months for the ferritin to start to rise. So don't be dismayed if you don't see an initial rise. It may take a little time, but you will get there with alternate day dosing of low dose iron. Thank you, Lisa. Wake me up, Andrew. Wake up, Andrew. So iodine, huge issue in the, particularly the eastern seaboard of Australia. Why not Perth? I don't know. But particularly, and I say the eastern seaboard, and it's not just the eastern seaboard, the eastern states, there's been data done in Wagga and Victorian border. So how do you approach iodine? Do you get your kids to eat eggs?
No, seaweed.
Seaweed?
So, you know, the little packets of nori, like it's
yes.
seaweed. So it's probably got some unhelpful oil on it. But again, that's a sea vegetable. So we're thinking about plant foods. Kids don't see seaweed as a vegetable. They think it's, you know, just a crunchy snack. So a lot of, I get kids eating nori quite easily, quite often. Just a couple of packets a week is enough to do it.
I think the major problem with those packets is they're so light. They just, you pick them up and it's like anti-gravity. They just flick out of your hands. My son particularly loves the chili one. Something interesting I learned recently, this was, again, I've mentioned it again, but the Cell Logic Symposium. And forgive me, I cannot remember your name, Mitten. She was talking about the expansive uses of seaweeds. And this lady had seaweed containing chocolate. And it was gorgeous. It was spectacular. And I thought, oh my goodness, if there's a way of getting the benefits, the many benefits of seaweed into our patients, have chocolate. I've got to find out. I'll put it into the show notes, everyone, because I was so impressed with this woman's talk about how they're employing seaweeds for specific benefits. Fantastic work. It's awesome. I love it. Aquaculture.
Yeah. We get a salt down here that has seaweed in it, and it's amazing. Mm. I love it. I can't remember who makes it, but it's a local, it's a Shoalhaven company that makes it.
Oh, well, we'll put it into the show notes for those patients that might be down there or want to procure it from somewhere. I'd love any information that we can help these kids out in increasing their dietary intake so that it's more diverse. I think it's worth a shot. So nutraceuticals, iodine, iron, zinc, vitamin D.
Yeah. If I can get them to do a blood test in particular, I'll find that a lot of them are extremely deficient, and that's an easy one to take because a couple of sprays again.
Yeah. So you favour the sprays there.
Yeah.
What else have we got? Do you ever use multivitamin mineral supplements? There was some really good work done by Professor Julia Rutledge in New Zealand using a multivitamin nutritional supplement for ADHD kids.
Yeah.
Do you tend to use them for kids with anxiety, or do you tend to be more specific?
Yeah, I will use a multivitamin, but unfortunately, they're not very well accepted from a taste point of view. The good quality ones, like all children will eat the gummies from the supermarket that have nothing in them, but the higher quality ones, it's a struggle to get kids to take them. So I don't use them that much just for that reason. I just don't have a very good success rate with them. But again, I'll get a compound made if I really need the child to get, like coenzyme Q10 as well as some B vitamins, because all that helps with your chewing as well, the B vitamins. So, but one thing that I have to mention that I use with all my fussy eaters is flower remedies.
Right. Let's talk about it. Let's go there. It's something I never think about.
Because it's the taste of nothing. You just add them to their child's water bottle. So I use bush and bach, just depending. And, you know, in the bush, Croea for anxiety can just have a massive, massive impact. So I just look at the child and look at their, you know, symptoms about rigidity or constipation or whatever it is, and just choose the appropriate flower remedies for them. And it's an easy way to get off the starting blocks and just lower their resistance to trying new foods.
And what about things like magnesium, essential fatty acids? I mean, we could keep going.
Yeah, I mean, kids need all of it. So it's just a matter. And fish oil is good, again, because you just syringe it in. Just like, here's your Panadol and syringe it in.
So you tend to use one of the flavoured liquid fish oils, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay, obviously we can't mention brands, but let's talk about flavours. Any particular flavours that are more accepted by kids, like peppermint at all or not? What, raspberry?
Peppermint has a very poor hit rate.
Right.
The flavour that my clients always ask me for is banana. They said, what do you have that's banana flavoured? So that, they don't want an authentic banana flavour. They want the antibiotic banana flavour, you know, that lolly banana.
That's
what kids want.
Okay, so as we've discussed before, you need to get a good supplement in by any means you can. What if you gave, maybe not peppermint wouldn't go well, but let's say an orange flavour. If there was an orange flavoured fish oil and you followed it with a banana lolly, you know, those banana flavoured lollies, would you do that? Would you employ that just to get it in as an acceptance?
Just use a chaser. Yeah.
Yeah, a chaser. They mean different things as you grow up, don't they? Okay, we're going to be putting in as much information as we can into the show notes. And forgive me, everyone, I am restricted on Buzzsprout to the word count. So I'm going to be putting more up on our natmedpartners.com.au website because I want this to be as comprehensive as I can. Lisa, can I ask right now, do you have any other resources where practitioners can learn from?
Yeah. So there will be a course coming in 2024.
Yeah.
So I will get you to put the link in the show notes, which
absolutely.
To just sign up, and you'll be the first to know when that course is ready once you sign up.
Brilliant.
With the link. And yeah, that will be in 2024.
Okay, awesome. And you'll be covering all of these hints and tips that you have because it's just so expansive. I love your mind.
Yeah, it'll be covering everything to do with fussy eating, from the constipation and the reflux to the nutrient deficiencies and the anxiety, ARFID, PANS. It's covering everything because it really frustrates me when I see people ask for advice about fussy eating and the advice is give them zinc. It's like, yes, that's great. Zinc will help and they do need zinc, but there are 99 other things that you need to do as well. And you probably won't get much of a real change from just getting zinc.
Yeah, salient point. Let's move over into some herbs. What sort of herbs do you employ, particularly, let's say, constipation? Do you tend to use calming herbs, not stimulatory herbs? So the more chamomiles and things like that that help the child relax?
Yeah. I use a lot of chamomile, passion flower, lemon balm. But for constipation, I do stick more to the prebiotics. I use some yellow dock as well for constipation. I keep with herbs, I keep it really gentle. And, you know, if the dose for the child is actually 5 mils based on their weight, and the parent says they won't take it, so give them one drop. Just give them one drop.
Right.
And then, you know, next week we might give them 2 drops. So again, slow progress, much better than no progress. So, you know, and sometimes with that very, very, very low dose, you can get a really good effect.
Isn't it interesting? You know, we're all taught about these macro dosing of herbs. Those people that have been taught by Dorothy Hall, those wise practitioners, obviously know about drop dosing. But you can't tell me that drop dosing doesn't work because of way of opinion, because one of the highest rated pharmaceuticals to do with the gut, and I have to say, oh, no, I don't. It's a WSG formula. I've forgotten the code. But it contains bitter candy tuft and hilodonium and things like that. And it's used for irritable bowel syndrome. That's its hallmark. But it's useful in many other gut conditions. And it's a drop dosage. It's 25 drops, so it's 1 mil.
Yeah.
So I totally get your point about introducing by stepwise fashion, even if it's 1-2 drops
Yeah.
at a time to get them to desensitize.
And I'll use ginger, like drop a couple of
Oh.
doses of ginger before a meal. And again, you think that's crazy. No child is going to take a drop dose of ginger, but they do. And some of
Yeah.
them love it.
Yeah,
Because
absolutely.
it gets their appetite going, gets their gut moving. It's just amazing.
And I have released an Instagram post. I might even put that in. I've released an Instagram post about how ginger affects our microbiota, and it'll blow your mind. We think we talk to the food, that we eat the food and the food talks to us. The genes of the ginger talk to the genes of the bacteria, and the genes of the bacteria talk to us. It's like, I'm not saying that's the only pathway, but it's an important pathway. We've got to get out of us owning everything. We've got to get out of that mentality. The way that food interacts with bacteria is amazing. And like, I totally get your point about using a bacteria for a certain use. But if you can employ a food with that, and it doesn't have to be in the capsule, you can just have it at the same time. But if you can employ a food with that, it can improve your results out of sight. Incredible. Okay, so what have we gone through? Is there anything we've missed in herbs? What other herbs? Oh, nutrients, glutamine. Forgive me, I was going to ask this ages ago. Slippery elm, glutamine. Do you ever employ these?
Yeah, glutamine and colostrum, slippery elm in some of the formulations I use. Yeah, so if a child has a very inflammatory picture on their leaky on their gut testing, so your child might come with E. coli and all the stuff on their stool, but everything's just wild with inflammation. They'll use like glutamine and colostrum and then fish oil and everything just to calm everything down before we do anything more kind of active with their gut.
Gotcha. How high do you go with glutamine? Do you titrate the dosing up?
Yeah. So I based on, I think the adult dose is like 15,
That's
20
huge.
grams.
Yeah, 25
grams. Yeah, so I just use Clark's rule to work out the child's dose from that. So, 25 kilo child, they might be getting 5 grams a day.
And you put them on straight away, or do you introduce it slowly?
Yeah, just straight away, usually.
Yeah. Okay. No problems with compliance?
No, not for that.
All right. Anything that we've forgotten? What about other herbs? Here's one. I know this is a sort of roundabout way, but kids who are often zinc and iron deficient, they've often got really poor immune systems, not the least of which you've got kids who are affected by PANDAS, a strep infection. You've got many other infections in the gut. So do you ever employ the immune favoring herbs like echinacea, astragalus? Andrographis has got its particular issues, but again, it might be useful in, because its common name is king of bitters. It might help actually help digestion and constipation.
I don't use much andrographis, but echinacea, it's probably my favorite herb ever. And yes, kids and even adults that still see me, like they've just been sick for years, sick, 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 sick every month for years. Give them echinacea for a few months and they're like a new person. Because sometimes I'll see the parents, so the child will see me, and then the parents will be like, oh, maybe you can help me because I'm just always sick. So I'll send them all some echinacea. But yeah, echinacea for kids, just amazing.
Do you tend to use Glycitrac?
No, not with echinacea.
Really?
I just warn them, there'll be a tingle.
There'll be a tingle.
And also medicinal mushrooms. So I use like Taki Tail, Reishi, Maitake, all of those together for immunity as well.
And how do you get them to take those? Do you tend to use them in soups, mix them in with mashed potato? What?
Just as a tincture as well.
Straight?
Yep.
Oh, brilliant. Okay.
Yep.
Your game. I'm so glad you mentioned mushrooms. How could I forget medicinal mushrooms? And what about checking in yourself with the child? Let's say you've introduced a new supplement with a child who has constipation. Do you check in, by a text or email, or ask the parents to check in to say, yes, the child's taken it, no problems, and with good effect, no issues, or, minor gut pain? Or how do you check in with that?
Yeah, I mean, the system that I use for my practice has a messaging component to it. So we're keeping regular contact because I am seeing these people week after week after week. Like, we build a very close relationship. So I do message them in between, and they will message me if they've got problems, especially with something like constipation, which can get dreadfully serious and dreadfully quickly. If they just say, I'll just wait till the next appointment to discuss it. It's like, no, I need to know. If your child's gone 3 days without a poo, you need to tell me so we can do something differently. So yeah, I make sure that those lines of communication are very open, because the last thing I want is for someone to come to me after 2 weeks and say, yeah, my child hasn't pooed for 14 days.
Like, are there any other things that you use?
Epsom salt baths is another good one.
Oh.
I do compound as well, you know, so things like L-theanine, GABA, magnesium, compound them for kids.
Beautiful.
Add anxiety as well. And that's easy for them to take generally as well. Glycine. Glycine's the other amazing one. Tastes like sugar.
Yeah.
Their histamine reduces their anxiety, helps their sleep, helps their gut. It's like, does everything.
What about with anxiety? Have you ever employed, I've never used this myself, magnesium 3-8. Have you ever used that? How does it work? Do you find that it works with anxiety?
I use it because it comes as a compounding ingredient, but I have to say I haven't seen it work any better than like a different sort of magnesium, like bisglycinate or citrate or anything. So, but I do use it just because it's available for compounding, I guess.
Gotcha. And so we have to move on to, what about long-term prognosis? Now, you've said previously that you work with kids, you know, 12 months, 18 months. Have you ever revisited, or have they revisited you and said, look, I'm now a food engineer?
Yeah. Well, I'm not that old that I've had that longevity, but, you know, even within 12 weeks, because at the start, I get a parent to write down every single food that their child eats. So brand, type, like everything in the food, the list will be short. And I get them to rewrite the list at the end of, you know, 12 weeks or whatever. So that's often like, that's it. They're done in 12 weeks and they've just written the food. So I have never revisited them years down the track because, yeah, I'm just not, I'm not that old. But the kids that I'm still working with, like, they're, it's night and day from when they started to now.
That must be so fulfilling for you to see that change in not just the physical behaviors, but the mental, the mood improvements that you're seeing, and the improvement in resilience for that child, which they can use into adulthood, adolescence and adulthood. I mean, that must be so rewarding for you.
Because if you can't interact with the food, you can't cook. So with the older kids, they actually, I just bring them to my clinic and we cook together. And at the start, they can't hold a measuring spoon. It's like, they're just all fingers and thumbs. They just have no, you know, they put the spoon into container, like upside down.
Yeah.
And I go, what's, you know, you need to actually, and again, by the end of 12 weeks, they at least know what to do in a kitchen to make stuff. And I always have gloves, like food handler gloves on hand. So if there's any big sensory reactions, like, that's fine. We have a solution. We just put on the gloves. But I might have to use them one time, and then the next time they're rolling the bliss balls, or they're, you know, they're doing all the stuff with their hands, and their hands.
Yeah.
It's like, yes. Like, if you can be filthy and make bliss balls, then you're well on your way to being able to eat properly. Yeah.
Nothing better than using flour or anything like that, or, you know, coconut or stuff like that to get it all out of your hands. Chocolate.
Yeah.
And then you get to lick it off.
Yeah.
Lisa, we've mentioned the course. We'll definitely put that up, the link up there. But in the meantime, where can we find out more? Are there any other fantastic authors or books that you find inspiration from?
I kind of take a bit from everybody. So the feeding therapy course that I did is SOS feeding therapy. So that's the SOS approach to feeding. So that's kind of the foundation of my training, but they don't have any concept really of things like nutrient deficiencies, heavy metals, gut health. It's all very much about the oral motor skills and the sensory. So I take bits from that. And then there's a few other people. Melanie Potok, I think is how you say her name. So she has a million YouTube videos, which are really good to break it down into this is how you teach a child to chew food, and this is how you get them to move the food from the middle of the mouth to the side of their mouth. But nobody is still pulling it all together. Everybody is still looking at it from their lens of being a speech therapist or an occupational therapist.
I'm going to be so looking forward to this course. This is going to be just brilliant. Lisa Moan, thank you so much for sharing. It's not just your expertise, but your care for your patients and their journey. And I'm picking up also that you have this real love of seeing that change in your patients, of helping them to overcome an issue that they've had with, you know, a certain food, whether it be sensory or whatever, some behavioral issue that's relating to their food, but which also impacts on their macro, if you like, their whole person, being that they have a state of anxiety, which you can help them move through. You're a brilliant practitioner. Thank you so much for taking us through these two podcasts. And I look forward to your course in the near future. It's going to be exciting.
Thank you very much, Andrew.
And thank you, everyone, for joining us today. We're going to be putting as much information as we can, certainly the link to Lisa Moan's course when it's due. So I think in the beginning stages, we're going to be getting people to register for interest. Is that right, Lisa?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, great. And then the course will be released in due time. Thank you so much, everyone, for joining us today. I hope you've gotten a lot out of these two videos, because I certainly have, these two podcasts, I should say. And remember, you can find all these research papers that we mentioned, all the show notes. They'll be up on the Buzzsprout, and they'll also be up on the natmedpartners.com.au website. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Andrew Whitfield-Cook.